Welcome to So Ordered, where we create audio readings of SCOTUS decisions to make them more accessible to the public. At the time of creating this podcast, the Supreme Court of the United States does not release audio of the court's decisions. Our mission is to make it so the public can be better informed on decisions of the court by using AI to generate audio of written opinions. The case before us today is Trump v. Cook, docket number 25, A312, decided June 29, 2026. Before reading the opinion itself, here is a brief summary of the case and the questions presented. In August 2025, President Trump purported to fire Lisa Cook, a member of the Board of Governors of the Federal Reserve System, after the director of a federal housing agency accused her of mortgage fraud in connection with loans she had taken out before joining the board. Cook was the first governor the president had ever attempted to remove in the central bank's 111-year history. She promptly sued, arguing that the removal was not for cause as the Federal Reserve Act requires, and that the president had, in any event, failed to give her the notice and opportunity to respond that the statute and the Constitution demand. The district court issued a preliminary injunction blocking her removal. The Court of Appeals declined to stay it, and the government then asked the Supreme Court to stay that injunction while the litigation continued. This case reached the court in an unusual posture. Rather than arriving through the usual petition for certiorari with formally presented questions, it came to the court on the government's emergency application to stay the district court's injunction. The court deferred that application, heard oral argument, and resolved the case on the application itself, deciding whether the government was likely to succeed in showing that the president could remove Cook and that she should not remain in office while the case proceeded. The court held, the government's application for a stay is denied. The government did not show that it is likely to prevail on the arguments in its stay application, which together would have transformed the Federal Reserve's for-cause protection into at-will employment. The court resolved the case on a narrow ground. Before removing a governor for cause, the president must give notice and some opportunity to respond, and President Trump did not do so here. Because Cook did not receive that process, the district court's injunction keeping her in office remains in effect while the litigation continues. Chief Justice Roberts delivered the opinion of the court, joined by Justices Sotomayor, Kagan, Kavanaugh, and Jackson. Justices Kavanaugh and Jackson each filed concurring opinions. Justice Thomas filed a dissenting opinion. Justice Alito filed a dissenting opinion, joined by Justice Gorsuch. And Justice Barrett filed a dissenting opinion. As a reminder, the audio is an AI-generated reading of a published opinion of the Supreme Court of the United States. The voice you will hear has been synthesized to loosely resemble that of the justice that wrote the opinion. All tone, inflection, pacing, and emphasis are produced by the AI model and should not be attributed to any justice. The text itself has been lightly adapted to aid in the creation of the spoken delivery. This is a project to attempt to make court decisions more accessible to the public, and any substantive changes during the reading are completely unintentional. Please visit www.supremecourt.gov to read the opinion published by the court. You can find a link directly to the opinion in this episode's description. As the audio is AI-generated, you may hear some audio glitches, including odd pronunciation, noticeable pauses, or repeated words. We do our best to remove these and hope they do not impact your listening experience. To leave us feedback on the show or to learn more about the podcast, please visit so-ordered.org. The following is the opinion of the court in Trump v. Cook.
Last August, for the first time in the Federal Reserve's 111-year history, the president attempted to fire one of its governors. A few weeks later, a federal court issued an injunction to prevent him from doing so. We decide whether that order should remain in effect pending the conclusion of litigation over the attempted removal. Our nation's first de facto central bank predates even our Constitution. Through the early years of the Revolutionary War, the Continental Congress had been forced to print so much money to finance the war that its currency had become all but worthless. Duty compels me, General Washington wrote to Congress in 1780, to request some solution to the great depreciation of the money for fear of mutiny in the ranks. To solve the problem, Congress realized, it would have to tie its own hands to place the power to create money elsewhere in an entity that could credibly serve as a principal pillar of American credit by the ties of private interest. Thus was born the Bank of North America. Its structure was unusual. it was to be owned in part by the government, at least at first, and in part by the public, run by directors accountable only to private stockholders and yet tasked with public purposes, specifically the maintenance of a sound national currency. But it worked. Such a bank was a necessity, Thomas Paine later wrote, for what with the depreciation of the currency, the slow operation of taxes, and the petitions to be exempt therefrom, the treasury was moneyless, and the government credit less. Alexander Hamilton said the same. The aid afforded to the United States by this institution during the remaining period of the war, he wrote, was of essential consequence. But the bank was short-lived as a solely national institution. It accepted state charters in 1782, and its national charter lapsed alongside the Articles of Confederation in 1789. Another national bank, however, quickly followed in its footsteps. In 1791, at Hamilton's urging, the First Congress chartered a bank that came to be known as the First Bank of the United States, with similar goals to the Bank of North America, and a similar degree of independence from the Congress that gave it life. Like the Bank of North America, the First Bank would be owned in part by the federal government, but run by directors accountable only to private stockholders. To Hamilton, that was key. To attach full confidence to an institution of this nature, he wrote, it appears to be an essential ingredient in its structure, that it shall be under a private, not a public direction, one that could resist the temptations of momentary exigencies. Under a public direction, Hamilton feared, suspicion of political manipulation would continually corrode the vitals of the credit of the bank and would be most likely to prove fatal in those situations in which the public good would require that they should be most sound and vigorous. Although the charter for the First Bank was allowed to expire in 1811, it took only 5 years for Congress to reverse course. As Chief Justice Marshall remarked in our court's first major decision on the breadth of the federal government's enumerated powers, a short experience of the embarrassments to which the refusal to revive the First Bank exposed the government, severe financial instability following the War of 1812, convinced those who were most prejudiced against the measure of its necessity. That necessity led to the Second Bank of the United States, encouraged even by President Madison, previously an ardent foe. Like its predecessors, the Second Bank was not to be controlled by the federal government that brought it into existence. Of its 25 directors, only 5 were appointed and removable by the president. The remaining 20 were appointed by and accountable only to private stockholders. The Second Bank's independence, however, was to prove its downfall. Unlike James Madison, Andrew Jackson had not and would not change his mind on the wisdom of a national bank, at least one he could not control. He savaged the Second Bank as a hydra of corruption only he could slay. So in 1832, when Congress passed a bill to extend the Second Bank's charter, it met with Jackson's veto and his famous veto message. He refused to make the rich richer and the potent more powerful at the expense of the humble members of society, the farmers, mechanics, and laborers. As Tocqueville observed, the common people rallied round the president. Jackson easily won re-election, and that was the end of the Second Bank. It would take almost 80 years before Congress would try again, and only after an era of ruinous financial panics, the ones of 1837, 1857, 1873, 1893, and 1907. These crises were in no small part attributable to Jackson's crusade. Without an independent central bank, there was no way to contain the damage whenever a major institution fell, no lender of last resort that could allow sound banks with good but temporarily illiquid assets to access cash, no elastic currency that could expand to meet demand, and no mechanism to ensure that small banks issued loans only within their means in the first place. It was a system devised for fair weather, not for storms, said President McKinley's Secretary of the Treasury. It took the panic of 1907 to force action. A failed attempt by speculators to corner the copper market led to the quick collapse of two banks, and the contagion spread from there, ultimately toppling some 2,000 firms and 130 banks. A bipartisan congressional commission eventually recommended the creation of a central bank to assume the serious duty of protecting public and private interests at times when they are imperiled. What emerged from these debates is today's central bank, called the Federal Reserve System, first created in 1913 and then restructured in 1933 and 1935. Modeled upon our federal political system, the Federal Reserve consists of two layers. At its base sit 12 independent but affiliated banks, one for each region, with their own responsibility in local affairs. These regional banks, called Federal Reserve Banks, are privately owned and operated by the commercial banks of the area. Above those banks are two national bodies, the Federal Open Market Committee and the Board of Governors. The former sets monetary policy nationwide, and the latter supervises the system from the national point of view with an eye to the economy's long-run growth. It consists of 7 members, appointed by the President and confirmed by the Senate. Like the directors of its 3 predecessors, however, the Federal Reserve's governors do not serve at the President's pleasure. They instead serve staggered 14-year terms and may be removed only for cause. Lisa Cook was appointed to the Board of Governors in 2022, at first to complete only the final 2 years of Janet Yellen's unexpired term. A year later, however, President Biden nominated Cook to a full 14-year term, and the Senate again voted to confirm her. In the normal course, then, Cook's term on the Federal Reserve was set to expire in 2038. Over the course of 1 week in August 2025, however, the longevity of Cook's tenure was to be called into question. On August 20th, the Federal Housing Finance Agency's director, William Pulte, posted to social media a letter dated a week before. The letter was addressed to Attorney General Pamela Bondi, and it accused Cook of mortgage fraud. According to mortgage documents obtained by the agency, it stated, "It appears that Cook falsified bank documents and property records to acquire more favorable loan terms in 2021 by claiming 2 homes simultaneously as her principal residence." Less than 30 minutes later, President Trump posted to social media that Cook must resign now and linked to a news article about Pulte's letter. 2 days later, the president told reporters that what Cook did was bad and that he would fire her if she doesn't resign. 3 days after that, President Trump purported to fire Cook for cause. In a letter to Cook, he stated that he had reason to believe that she may have made false statements on 1 or more mortgage agreements. The American people must be able to have full confidence in the honesty of the members entrusted with setting policy and overseeing the Federal Reserve, he explained. But he lacks such confidence in Cook's integrity, he continued, in light of her deceitful and potentially criminal conduct, which at a minimum exhibited gross negligence. He thus determined that faithfully executing the law requires Cook's immediate removal from office. Cook promptly filed suit, seeking relief at law and at equity to allow her to stay in office. She alleged that the removal was not for cause, as required by statute. And in any case, she alleged, the president had failed to comply with the statutes and the Constitution's requirement that she receive notice and some opportunity to respond to the charges against her before being fired. The district court agreed, issuing a preliminary injunction to prevent her removal. It noted first that the scope of the dispute was narrowed by the government's concession, for purposes of this proceeding, that the statute itself is constitutional. It then turned to Cook's 2 claims, both of which it considered likely to succeed. As to the first, it held that the president had failed to state a legally permissible cause, because cause refers only to an official's in-office conduct or performance, a standard that could not be met here, given that the mortgages at issue predated Cook's tenure at the Federal Reserve. And as to the second, it held that the Constitution entitled Cook to notice and a hearing before her termination, process she had not received. The district court finally concluded that Cook faced irreparable harm without injunctive relief, and that the final two factors, the balance of equities and the public interest, strongly cut in her favor. The Court of Appeals declined to stay the injunction. Judge Garcia, joined by Judge Childs, filed a concurrence focused solely on Cook's due process claim. As a public official who may be removed only for cause, he contended, Cook has a property interest in her position and may not be removed summarily. Judge Katsas dissented. He would have rejected Cook's due process claim on the basis that a public official, unlike an employee, can have no property right in her position, and he would have held that a termination for cause merely requires some reference to a person's conduct, ability, fitness, or competence, a requirement that the president plainly met here. The government applied for a stay in this court. We deferred the application pending oral argument. This case comes to us not directly on the merits, but on the government's application for a stay, an order preventing the district court's ruling from going into effect, pending appeal to the Court of Appeals and, if necessary, to this court. The standards for such relief are well established. The applicant must show that it is likely to succeed on the merits of its appeal, that we would likely grant certiorari to review any decision to the contrary, that it will likely suffer irreparable harm in the interim, and that the balance of equities tip in its favor. We start and stop with the first factor. In our view, the government has not shown that it is likely to prevail on the various legal arguments advanced in its stay application. The government raises three alternative arguments: that a removal for cause under the statute is not judicially reviewable, that even if the removal is reviewable, cause is a low bar satisfied by any concerns about a governor's conduct, ability, fitness, or competence, and that even if the government did not show cause to remove Cook, she is nevertheless not entitled to remain in office while litigation over the removal is pending. We disagree on all three points. To accept any one of those arguments would, in effect, transform the Federal Reserve's for-cause protection into at-will employment, an interpretive leap out of step with the statute Congress enacted and our nation's tradition of central banking protected from political interference. We therefore deny the government's application. The government, but not Justice Thomas, contends that the president's determination of cause is wholly unreviewable. The statutory for-cause language at issue, the government argues, commits the determination of cause to the president alone. We see no such textual commitment. The statute provides that each member of the Board of Governors shall hold office for a term of 14 years, unless sooner removed for cause by the president. Whether a governor should be removed, it is true, is a decision only the president can make, short of impeachment. But that does not mean that he may make that decision for any reason or no reason. Even when a statute delegates discretionary authority to the executive branch, we have explained our role is, as always, to independently interpret the statute and effectuate the will of Congress subject to constitutional limits. Congress could, of course, afford the president the power to remove Federal Reserve governors at will. Or Congress could exempt the president's removal of governors for cause from judicial review. But Congress has done neither. The government appears to concede that at least some judicial review of a removal is available. It admits that federal courts may review the removal of a Federal Reserve Board member when, for instance, the president identifies no cause at all. But the only way for us to tell whether the president has identified cause under the statute is to interpret the statute and decipher what precisely it means by cause. As the government acknowledges in its supplemental brief, it is the task of a reviewing court to discern the boundaries of the president's power under the Federal Reserve Act. The government relies on Reagan v. United States, decided in 1901, but that case offers it no help. In Reagan, as the government explains, we said that the removal at issue was a matter of discretion and not reviewable, but not because all removals are, just the reverse. The statute at issue in Reagan limited removal for certain court officers to causes prescribed by law. The trouble was that no causes for removal were ever affirmatively specified by Congress. The plaintiff thus argued that he was entitled to hold office during life, or at least until Congress passes a law defining such causes. We rejected his argument. We said that we could not review the removal because no enumerated causes were defined by law, nor removal for cause provided for by the statute. The statute at issue here, by contrast, provides just that. With no support in Reagan, the government turns to the common law, which, it says, forecloses all judicial review. The common law, however, appears to cut the other way. See Hart B. Common Council of City of Duluth, 1893. Holding, the sufficiency and reasonableness of the cause of removal are questions for the courts. This has been the settled law ever since Bagg's case, and we are not aware of any respectable authority to the contrary. The government's four cited cases do not persuade us otherwise. The first two expressly declined to resolve the issue, and the last two address statutes that specified not only causes for removal, but also procedures for removal, which the court interpreted to be exclusive. See Phelps, 1893. Holding, interpreting the lawmaking body to have been of the opinion that no other check was necessary to prevent an arbitrary and oppressive abuse of the power of removal. We see no indication in the common law that the president should have a free hand. Even if the president's determination is judicially reviewable, the government, and Justice Thomas contend, cause sets a very low bar, one that the president easily cleared. In the government's view, cause includes any concern the president may have about a person's conduct, ability, fitness, or competence. That excludes a mere policy disagreement, according to the government, but it includes, among many other things, concerns about a person's integrity, precisely the cause given here. Cook, on the other hand, argues that cause sets a very high bar, one that the president failed to meet. In her view, Congress used for cause merely as a shorthand to refer to the existing causes for presidential removal of executive officers as defined by various other statutes. And at the time of this statute's reenactment in 1935, she explains, those causes were few, either poor performance in office, inefficiency, neglect of duty, or malfeasance or ineligibility for office in the first place. But, she argues, the president alleged neither. Her private, pre-office conduct, she concludes, can offer no cause at all. We find neither explanation persuasive. Although neither the government nor Justice Thomas say as much, both seem to acknowledge that Congress enacted this statute against the backdrop of the common law, such that we must look to the common law to decipher what cause, a term of art, requires. We ordinarily presume that Congress intends to incorporate the well-settled meaning of the common law terms it uses. Indeed, the one authority upon which the government relies for its definition of cause, the second edition of Black's Law Dictionary, itself defined cause based on two cases, each of which sought, in the common law tradition, to distill cause from general principles, customs, and judicial decisions across all states. Neither one of those cases, however, nor Black's itself, suggested that any reason would do. They instead emphasized that the cause identified must be substantial, reasonable, and just, a disqualification akin to inefficiency or incompetency, and Justice Thomas's test is too lenient, however, Cook's is too stringent. Cook argues that we should interpret cause to refer only to the specific causes provided in other statutes as basis for presidential removal, specifically, as of 1935, inefficiency, neglect of duty, malfeasance, and ineligibility. But we see no reason why that should be so. It is true, of course, that some statutes by their terms incorporate an external body of law, as when a statute refers generally to defenses available by law. That inference, however, works only if the statute actually references that body of law. The statute here does not. It refers to cause generally, Title 12 United States Code, Section 242, a concept familiar to the common law. it does not refer to causes that Congress has otherwise recognized as adequate. Having rejected both parties' positions, we need not fully demarcate the contours of cause today. For present purposes, it is sufficient to observe that any definition of cause in this context must reflect the Federal Reserve's unique historical status and role. Similarly, focusing upon the character of the office and the qualifications necessary to fill it. Like its predecessors, the Federal Reserve operates at a deliberate remove from the ordinary political process. It sets its own budget, free of congressional control. It consists in large part of privately owned and operated entities, namely the regional banks, and its policies are set not only by governors, but also by representatives of the private regional banks. Indeed, it is the Federal Reserve's independence that allows it to pursue its mandate of maximum employment, stable prices, and moderate long-term interest rates, goals that may be thwarted if, to quote Hamilton, suspicion arose that its operations were at the disposal of the government, which often may favor ephemeral short-term gains over long-term growth. Not only the fact of independence, but also the appearance of independence is key to the Federal Reserve's design. That counsels a substantial threshold for cause. It is true, of course, that cause cannot be reduced to a precise set of rules, and some close calls are inevitable. Whether cause for removal exists in any given situation will depend, at least in part, on the seriousness of the alleged misconduct and the extent of any nexus that may exist to the governor's professional duties. The key issue is whether the cause assigned truly implies an unfitness for the place, or whether it simply represents an effort to secure a more congenial replacement. Our review is deferential, but we are not required to exhibit a naivete from which ordinary citizens are free. Without such constraints in place, any perceived or alleged misstep, past or present, could provide a ready pretext for a governor's removal, a fact that he would surely know, and that would surely weigh on him as he decided what to say and how to vote. Nothing could be more corrosive of the independence that Congress sought to preserve. Even if the determination of cause is judicially reviewable and the definition of cause imposes a substantial threshold, the government, joined by Justice Thomas, contends that federal courts cannot grant a preliminary injunction ordering reinstatement during the pendency of litigation. On their view, all that a court may do is wait and perhaps award back pay later, even if the president fires a member of the board for an absurd reason or no reason, and even if the court holds that he broke the law in doing so. The law does not require such a result. The very treatise upon which the government and Justice Thomas rely, in fact, rebuts their argument. At least as a historical matter, as the government and Justice Thomas explain, courts of equity would not interfere by injunction to determine questions concerning the appointment of public officers or their title to office. But such courts frequently recognized and protected the possession of officers de facto, pending a litigation at law to determine their title. Put another way, a court of equity would not and could not finally determine whether a plaintiff was validly removed. That was a question only a court of law could settle historically by quo warranto or mandamus. In the meantime, however, equity could ensure that the actual incumbents of an office may be protected, pending a contest as to their title, from interference with their possession and with the exercise of their functions, at least to the extent that they had a likely meritorious claim. The district court sought to do just that here. No equitable bar stood in its way, neither in Sawyer decided in 1888 nor White v. Berry decided in 1898 says otherwise. Both cases stand for the far more limited proposition, already discussed, that a court of equity has no jurisdiction over the appointment and removal of public officers, for such jurisdiction belongs exclusively to the courts of law. Neither case holds that equity is unavailable in the interim. As Professor Bray has explained, Sawyer and White reflect equity's overriding concern about the adequacy of legal remedies. Because the plaintiffs in those cases had effective legal remedies, like mandamus and quo warranto, to finally settle title to their offices, the only relief they sought, equity could not intervene. But that was not to preclude equitable remedies for de facto officers, like Cook, who required immediate relief to protect their status during the course of the litigation at law. In sum, a court may order that a removed governor remain in office during the pendency of litigation if the governor is otherwise entitled to a preliminary injunction. Otherwise, a president could remove a governor even while litigation over the removal was ongoing, and could do so for very lengthy periods of time without substantial cause for removal. That would significantly interfere with the independence of the Federal Reserve. Having rejected the government's view that the courts are to play no role in assessing the validity of a governor's removal, we may decide this application on narrow grounds. No matter the precise definition of cause, or the scope of our review of any such determination, the president failed to afford Cook the procedural protections to which she was entitled by statute. Without such protections, she could not properly dispute the charges the president laid against her. We thus need not address Cook's constitutional due process argument, for the statute alone makes it unlikely that the government will prevail on appeal as to the validity of the procedures used to fire Cook. Perhaps dissatisfied with the responses offered by the government, Justice Thomas and Justice Alito would ignore the statute altogether. We should do so, he contends, because the lower courts did so, ruling in Cook's favor based solely on the Due Process Clause. But we review judgments, not statements and opinions. That is why the question before us is whether we would likely reverse the judgment below, not whether we would likely disagree with some of the reasons given by the lower courts. Justice Alito does not contend that we would have to reverse the judgment below even if Cook were to prevail as to the statute. Nor does he contend that the statute was somehow waived or forfeited. It was, after all, one of Cook's lead points below. What he says instead is that the question is complicated and novel, a concern we of course share. When a party comes to us for interim relief, however, we cannot hide in the tall grass. Ultimately, we must grant or deny. Under our precedents, Cook was entitled to notice and some opportunity to respond prior to her termination. That comes down to the words Congress chose, first in 1913 and then again in 1935. When Congress created the Federal Reserve, it gave governors a set term in office and permitted removal only for cause. At that time, and indeed afterward, that form of tenure, a term of years limited only by removal for cause, carried with it a settled interpretation at common law, one that we had expressly adopted just a decade before. The rule, we explained in 1901, is that notice and hearing are essential before an officer's removal, where the term of office is for a fixed period. We said the same in 1903. Reagan and Shurtleff established the baseline against which Congress legislated, and we must construe its work accordingly. Of course, that is not to say that a Federal Reserve governor is entitled to an audience with the president or a full-blown judicial trial. But instead, all that is required is notice to the officer of the charges made against him and an opportunity to be heard in his defense. We see no reason why that opportunity may not be had on written materials only, with no oral presentation. All that is required is the right to support his allegations by argument, however brief, and, if need be, by proof, however informal, before a final decision is made. The government, joined by Justice Thomas, resists even this minimal process. It contends that we may not read atextual requirements into statutes and instead must focus only on the plain language. It is hardly atextual, however, to read text in context or to examine how this court interpreted such language at the time of the statute's enactment. If anything, it would be atextual to do otherwise. Indeed, even the government concedes that Congress, at least sometimes, should be taken to have implicitly incorporated these procedural requirements. The government acknowledges, for instance, that a statute limiting removal to specified causes, like inefficiency or malfeasance, would require pre-termination notice and a hearing, because this court expressly recognized as much in both Shurtleff and Reagan. But Shurtleff and Reagan said the same about statutes, like the one at issue here, that promise officeholders a term of years. Indeed, they said so in the exact same sentence. Where causes of removal are specified by constitution or statute, as also where the term of office is for a fixed period, notice and hearing are essential. The government's concession all but gives up its case. That disposes, too, of the government's related argument that Congress knows how to impose notice and hearing requirements expressly, and did not do so here. Again, what is true for a statute with specified causes is true for this statute, too. In both instances, notice and hearing are essential. And in any case, as we have said many times before, Congress not infrequently legislates in a hypervigilant way to remove any doubt as to things not particularly doubtful in the first instance. That Congress acted out of an abundance of caution in other statutes, most enacted decades after the one at issue here, hardly permits us to ignore the default rule our precedent had already made clear. Perhaps recognizing the government's bind, Justice Thomas would simply discard the rule announced in Reagan and Shurtleff as a single line of dicta. A single line, yes, dicta, no. Reagan and Shurtleff could hardly have been clearer about the rule they applied, that, to repeat once more, notice and hearing are essential if the term of office is for a fixed period. Thus, as Justice Thomas emphasizes, the officers in Reagan and Shurtleff ultimately lost because neither one enjoyed a fixed tenure. That does not make the rule dicta. Even so, Justice Thomas insists, we cannot presume that Congress intended to incorporate Reagan and Shurtleff's rule in the absence of some broader judicial consensus. We are not sure what more Justice Thomas wants. It is true, of course, that we have required broad and unquestioned consensus in the courts of appeals before presuming that Congress intended to incorporate into new legislation the lower court's interpretation of a particular word or phrase. The one case cited by Justice Thomas on this point, Learning Resources v. Trump, decided in 2026, stands for just that proposition. We have never said the same, however, about our own cases, of which Congress presumptively is aware. See, for example, Isleta del Sur Pueblo v. Texas, decided in 2022, finding that Congress implicitly relied upon an interpretation offered in just one of our prior opinions. Indeed, as a matter of vertical stare decisis, the lower courts have no choice but to follow our lead. When we define a term or establish a background rule, we need not repeat ourselves. Once is enough. With no support in Reagan and Shurtleff, Justice Thomas goes for broke. Once again, far outflanking the government, which does not contest the constitutionality of the statute, Justice Thomas declares the statute unconstitutional, an infringement on the president's power to remove his subordinates at will. We disagree, as did the founders of our government and framers of our Constitution when they were actively participating in public affairs. They knew from experience, and Hamilton reminded them, of the calamities that could arise from even the suspicion of political manipulation of monetary policy. So when they established the First Bank of the United States, they guaranteed its independence from presidential control. Their successors did the same for the Second Bank. That enabled both banks to serve as the great regulating wheel of the early American financial system. The Federal Reserve follows in this lineage. It is true, of course, that this tradition has not stood still. As Justice Thomas notes, the Federal Reserve is more powerful than its predecessors, managing a vastly more complex economy in a vastly more complex world. We see no reason, however, why our central bank ought to be trapped in amber any more than any other aspect of our constitutional scheme. What matters is that the Federal Reserve remains consistent with the principles that underpin the first and second banks, namely, that monetary policy should not be subject to political interference. In our view, the Federal Reserve maintains the balance struck by the founding generation under modern circumstances. We thus look to history not as an end in itself, but as we often do, to give essential content to undefined provisions in the frame of our government. Justice Barrett objects that we discuss this issue at all, even if only in response to Justice Thomas. How much to say on our interim docket and how much to say in response to a dissent is not reducible to any mechanical formula. It is ultimately a matter of prudence upon which reasonable minds can and often do disagree. In this extraordinary case, we have had the benefit of not only amici and oral argument, but months of internal consultation and deliberation. We see no reason to leave the public in limbo or to sow doubt as to the status of one of our nation's and the world's most important financial institutions. Although we appreciate that others may see matters differently, we would not so quickly unsettle this special arrangement sanctioned by history. As a last resort, the government half-heartedly contends that Cook in fact received due process after all. In its view, the president gave Cook notice and an opportunity to be heard when he first posted about the matter on social media. That is, despite the fact that the president's post did not suggest that a response from Cook would be appropriate, nor did it even provide a clear account of the charge made against her. It instead read, simply, Cook must resign, now, and link to a news article about Pulte's letter. That will not do. At minimum, Cook was entitled to some explanation of the evidence at issue, some avenue for a response, and a deadline by which a response would be due. Because Cook did not receive such process, her removal was erroneous and void from the start, a principle recognized succinctly by Lord Coke as early as 1615 in a case holding, a removal without hearing the party removed is bad. Of course, that is not to say that a response from Cook necessarily would have changed the president's mind, but as the government rightly acknowledges, the right to a hearing does not depend on demonstration of certain success. It at least remains an open question what precisely happened here, and indeed whether Cook committed gross negligence, let alone deceitful and potentially criminal conduct, as the president's letter alleges. Those are factual issues that we cannot determine in the first instance, and certainly not on the sparse record here, which does not even include the mortgage documents at issue, nor any other evidence that the government or Cook may consider relevant. Only after Cook has had the opportunity to respond to the charges made against her by argument, however brief, and, if need be, by proof, however informal, may a final decision be made. And only then can the courts assess the validity and sufficiency of such charges. As the government concedes, Congress limited the president's power to remove governors for good reason, to preserve the independence of the Federal Reserve, and to continue the long tradition of monetary policy exercised independent of executive influence. Any change in that scheme must come from Congress, not the courts. That is why we cannot accept the government's contentions in this case. To do so would allow the president to remove a member of the Federal Reserve at any time, for any reason, without any notice before, and without any judicial check after. That would turn for-cause protection into little more than at-will employment. To be clear, the ultimate question of whether the president can remove Cook for cause will depend in part on the underlying facts. In this opinion, we have not addressed the facts as they have yet to be found or analyzed under the relevant legal standards. Rather, we have simply addressed the party's arguments about the appropriate legal standards under which the facts must be evaluated. The application for a stay is denied. It is so ordered.